Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out the Here We Still Stand Regional Conference in Bentonville, Arkansas. As you know, the national conference has been sold out for a long time, and this is your opportunity to come to a 1517 conference if you wanted to come to one, which if you don't want to come to one, obviously, you've not been to one if you don't want to come to one, because if you ever had been, you'd want to come. So come hang out with Chad and myself and a whole bunch of other people for 2 days in the Ozarks. That is May 5th and 6th. It's $99 to come. There's a link in the show notes. That is going to sell out. It is getting closer and closer to selling out. That will happen. So don't delay. Go ahead and get those tickets. Chad, last episode, we had, you know, some hair-raising speeches given, you know, to not just to a king, not just to his messengers, but to everybody to hear about all the horrible things that were going to happen if Judah doesn't cooperate. And we had Hezekiah, you know, tell his people, hey, don't listen to these people, don't worry about what they say. But then Hezekiah goes and he decides to go and pray. You know, and he's got the sackcloth going on. He's got all the brought low stuff that you need to have. And in this prayer, you understand that, you know, he's trying to, you know, present himself to the people as someone that's calm. It's going to be okay. Don't listen to anything they have to say. But you listen to his prayer, and you're like, this guy's got nothing. I mean, this guy's got God, and that's it. Then he goes to Isaiah, and Isaiah says, hey, that's just the sort of stuff that God can work with. And we're going to get to this episode. We get to start out with Isaiah talking about what this God, which is all Hezekiah has, kind of how he's going to intervene in this whole situation.
Yeah, well, I guess eventually we'll cover the same material. I don't know when that's going to be. It's going to be a few years down the road. But a lot of this material that we're covering now, it's paralleled, of course, in Isaiah's own writings. But Isaiah here is going to give us a little taste of the kinds, or the writer of Kings is going to give us a taste of the kind of material that we're going to find all over Isaiah. So it's poetry, for one. So if you're actually looking in your Bible while you're listening along, you'll see that it's even set up differently on the page, so you can tell that it's not prose, but poetry. Typical prophetic kind of preaching that's going to happen here. So 2 Kings 19, verse 20, after Hezekiah's prayer, we're going to have now Isaiah's message as to exactly what God has in store for this guy who is this Assyrian guy who's so full of himself. So Isaiah, the son of Amoz, sent to Hezekiah, saying, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, your prayer to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard. That's always a great, that'd be a great word to hear. Yeah. You know, your prayer, Chad, that you offered concerning blank, I have heard. That's a pretty good promise coming from God. I was listening. I heard what you had to say.
It's a good way to start. Because at that moment, you're like, well, at least he heard it. Now, I don't know what the response is. So this is a good starting point. So I heard it. And you're saying, you want to know, great. How'd you feel about it? What's your opinion?
Yeah, yeah. What'd you really think about the prayer? I mean, you heard it. That's good. Glad that you did. Now, what do you have to say? And of course, that's what follows. Verse 21. This is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning him. And the him here, of course, is Sennacherib, the one who sent his envoys to speak all these boastful, provocative, and even blasphemous words as they were standing outside the walls of Jerusalem. So here is what the Lord has to say. She despises you. She scorns you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She wags her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. Let us stop there for a second. So this despising, this scorning, of course, is exactly what the Assyrians are doing to God's people, to the Israelites. And I think some of the language here is also indicative of the threat that is faced by Jerusalem. So she's called the virgin daughter of Zion. Now, you read the commentaries on Kings, and several of them will make the comment that kind of what is alluded here is that what the city faces is basically it is a Syrian rapist. I mean, that's the kind of language commentaries will use. They're there to molest Jerusalem. They're there to enter into her gates and to just do with the city and its inhabitants whatever they want to do. And what God is saying is that's not going to happen. the virgin daughter of Zion is going to be safe with me. He's going to protect her from this Assyrian onslaught. And then he goes on to say, she wags her head behind you. That's typical Hebrew language for what happens when somebody's scorning or mocking somebody else. So I don't know what the, because we don't talk about wagging the head in English. I'm not sure what head movement we would use
in an English idiom
to capture this, but we don't talk about, oh yeah, this, I was at the store this day and I got an argument with this guy and he was wagging his head at me. No, that's just not something that we speak about.
The wagging of the head is a pretty common thing in the Bible. Like, this is not a rare phrase that comes up. I mean, it's in the New Testament. It talks about
Psalm 22, the crucifixion psalm, says, all who see me mock me, they make mouths at me, they wag their heads.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a head motion. It's a nonverbal expression that you use when you're scorning someone. So like I said, I don't know what that would correspond to in our English idiom, but that's what it means. She wags her head.
I don't know if it's like making faces, you know. It would it be someone that's mocking you with maybe this is what comes to my mind when I think about wagging the head. I was watching a basketball game and there was a technical foul, so a guy got to shoot free throws all by himself. There's no one, he's on the court, everyone else has to go back. And it's a road game, and he's shooting these free throws, and so the crowd is freaking out. They're trying to make it, you know, trying to distract him, make him miss. He makes them both, and then he takes his hands and does like this boo-hoo thing, like over his eyes, you know, like has his hands near his eyes, and he's like you know, moving them back and forth like the boo-hoo thing. My guess is it's like something like that. It's a bodily thing that you do with your head that is an obvious because it's always associated with mocking.
Yeah, I mean this is
a nonverbal
childish
taunt.
And juvenile. Yes, this is childish and juvenile, but it'd be like sticking your tongue out at somebody.
Yeah,
like kids do. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. So however you want to envision it, that's what's going on when you hear that phrase wagging the head. We don't even use the word wag unless we're talking about a dog's tail.
Yeah.
We don't talk about heads wagging. But anyway. So that's what they're doing to Zion. And then he goes on, whom have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes to the heights? Now, it would seem like the one who's been mocked and reviled is Jerusalem, but that's not his answer. So who have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes to the heights? Here's the answer: against the Holy One of Israel. So they may think that they have been wagging their head and mocking Jerusalem, but no, they've been actually mocking God himself, the Holy One of Israel. Then he goes on, by your messengers, you have mocked the Lord. And here's what you've said. With my many chariots, I have gone up to the heights of the mountains, to the far recesses of Lebanon. I felled its tallest cedars, its choicest cypresses. I entered its farthest lodging place, its most fruitful forest. I dug wells and drank foreign waters, and I dried up with the sole of my foot all the streams of Egypt. So this is putting words into the mouth of the Assyrians, especially their king, where he's boasting about all these great accomplishments that are on his resume. You know, he's gone up to the very tops of the mountains with his axe, and he's chopped down those tall cedars of Lebanon and their cypresses. And he went all the way into foreign countries, and he as it were, drank up all the water of their ground. He dug some wells there, and he just sucked all the water out of Egypt, or sucked all the water of Syria, or whatever it might be. And then he walks around everywhere the sole of his foot plants, he dries up the streams of Egypt. So this is hyperbolic language, of course, which is typical of a poetry. Hyperbolic language put in the mouth of the king of Assyria, basically to show how full of himself that he is. He thinks he's a god, more or less, is kind of what the implication is of all this language.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this. I mean, you're not talking about guys that simply think king is the most powerful person, you know, most important person or anything like that. There's a king isn't only set in place by God, whatever God that is. you have ascended to godhood, right? And so it's you and God. This is why it's funny, because King of Kings is a phrase that we as Christians hear. This is in the scripture, right? The King of Kings, and we would associate.
Yeah,
that.
Well, we use that all the time in preference to Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah, and we would never associate that with like just somebody. We wouldn't say like David is the King of Kings, or you know, Solomon, or that's exactly the title that all of these kings use for themselves. That's who they were. And what does that mean? It's like, well, I'm not just a king. I'm the king. I'm over all the kings of the earth. In other words, I'm God.
I'm the guy. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Humility is not an Assyrian virtue.
No.
especially when it comes to their kings. I mean, this was pretty common in the ancient world, which I think maybe a couple episodes we talked about that this idea that kings were either godlike or actually gods, or kind of an apotheosis or an incarnation of a god, as it were, in Egypt. And that was pretty common in the ancient world, you know. So we complain today about politicians being full of themselves and arrogant, which, you know, is a legitimate complaint and criticism. But I mean, they really got nothing compared to these ancient kings. I mean, these guys, they were it, and they thought they were it anyway. Yeah. So, and that kind of hubris is what you see reflected here in the language that Isaiah puts into the mouth of the Assyrians. And they've gone as far up as you can possibly go to the heights of the mountains. They've gone far down as you can possibly go. They've dug these wells in foreign soil. And basically they're saying, we're masters. We're the King of Kings. We may appear to be human, but we're actually divine. So,
taken a lot of losses up to this point. There's not been a lot of, at this point, there's no evidence to the contrary. You know, I mean,
right.
I mean, you're doing a lot of winning.
Yeah, which I mean, from their perspective is great. In the bigger perspective is like one of the worst things that can happen to someone who's arrogant and full of themselves is when they have a string of victories, because of course, what does that do but strengthen their own hubris?
Yeah,
it makes them secure in their overinflated view of who they are. So after having said all this, after the Lord, through Isaiah, having put these words in the mouth of the Assyrians, which are, as it were, a summary of their own self-evaluation, their own self-importance, he then shifts to say this, verse 25. Haven't you heard? Which I love that it starts out. Did you not get the memo? Haven't you heard that so this is God speaking, that I determined it long ago? I planned from days of old what now I bring to pass, that you should turn fortified cities into heaps of ruins, while their inhabitants, shorn of strength, are dismayed and confounded, and have become like plants of the field and like tender grass, like grass on the housetops, blighted before it's grown. But I know, well, let me stop there. So that's verses 25 through 26. So God's basically saying, wait, you think that like all of these judgments that you have inflicted upon other peoples is because of your own prowess in battle, or your own divine status, or your own whatever you think belongs to you? No, I mean, are you so stupid that you don't realize that long ago, like before you were even king, before you've been born, long before that, I already decided this is the way things were going to go down, because as it turns out, I'm God and you're not. I'm omniscient and you're not. I planned all this. In fact, I've been even announcing it through my prophets that these things were going to come to pass. So you get zero credit for all these things that you think are occurring to your favor and making you look so strong and mighty and divine.
Yeah, and you can see that if you actually go read the prophets. You know, we're in that kind of weird place where we're reading a historical narrative, but then we're going to get into books where there's prophets writing about the things that are going on in these historical narratives. Maybe if you were to pick up some kind of a chronological Bible, and it would have this stuff sort of interwoven, you would get the feel for it. But you see in the prophets that the prophets will say things. God will say things to the prophets. Behold, I am going to raise up blank, and whatever it is, it'll be some power, some people, some king, and I'm going to use that king to accomplish what it is that I want to accomplish. And a lot of times, that whether that's I'm going to have them defeat these people, or I'm going to have them take you away into captivity for being a bunch of idolatrous children. And so, this isn't like the first time that God is like saying something like this. I mean, the prophets, Isaiah is saying all this kind of stuff all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So the axe that God wields to, you know, chop down the Israelite tree of rebellion or whatever. Yeah, this stuff happens with some frequency. And it's almost always followed then by a rebuke.
Yeah.
So God will say, okay, I raised you up to do this thing. But at the same time, you are responsible for your own guilt. Because even though I raised you up to bring about this judgment against my idolatrous people, what you've turned around and done is basically say that this was done all independently, all because of your own skill and because of your divine status, blah, blah, blah. So God can take the axe by which he punishes his people and burn that axe in the fire.
Yeah.
Which he does with great frequency in the Old Testament.
Yeah. My favorite example of that, I think I brought up before, is in Habakkuk, when God says, hey, write this down. It's going to be awesome. I'm raising up this people group, and they're just going to devastate everything. And Habakkuk's like, oh, that's not good. I don't like this. It's not good. It's not good at all. And God's like, oh, it's happening. I'm going to raise up these kingdoms, and then they're going to cart you off, and they're going to punish you. And then, like, a chapter later, God is telling him, the hubris on these people to persecute my people is unbelievable. And It's pretty jarring because, at one moment God's saying, I'm the one raising him up and I'm the one that's going to do it. And then the next minute he's angry with the people that are doing this because he holds them entirely responsible.
Yeah. We don't use the word sovereignty a lot, but it does apply there. I mean, this is the all-powerful sovereign God. He's the one who's, which I think is important, because a lot of people in the ancient world thought that their gods were just, you know, they were active in their area. It was a god of this region doing this thing, you know, but it wasn't like the god of the Ammonites was down in Egypt manipulating events, or it wasn't like the god of Egypt was in Assyria manipulating events. I mean, they had a very kind of circumscribed view of the area over which the god had control. And then along comes Yahweh and he's like, oh, no, I'm the God of heaven and earth. So it doesn't matter where you're at. Israel, Egypt, Assyria, America, it doesn't matter. I am the Lord over all. And so, yeah, I'm going to be kind of moving. I'm going to be shuffling pieces around on this international chessboard. And it's all my doing.
Yeah, the way that Israel views their God is very different. I mean, this seems like the peak amount of gods in the history of the kind of Middle East area. And every little people group's got their own god. And what the Assyrians would do is they would go in there and they would just take your god from you. Because they all had like a statue or something, and they just take him. And then you don't have one. And there was this rubbing your face, and they're like, yeah, we've got your god captive. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't do this with with Judah. You couldn't do the same kind of thing. So, I mean, for example, they literally took... So Marduk, they had like this big gold statue that weighed like 1,000 pounds or something crazy. And to go to war, you had to go and grab its hands and make a covenant or basically with it, and then you could go to war. Well, they just had a real simple solution to that. They just went, took it, melted it down. You don't have a god anymore. There's no hand to grab. And you'd be like, well, that's ridiculous. That wouldn't work. It did work. They couldn't go, these people couldn't go to war. Like, these people actually believe this stuff. Well, Judah's different. They don't have that sort of thing going on. And their God is not just consigned to this region. They don't have, you know what? If you want to know one of the practical reasons, God doesn't want you to have a bunch of images of golden calves and stuff. Well, this is a good reason not to do that.
Yeah, God's you can't not steal an imageless God.
Yeah, you can take your God into captivity. And they were taking everyone's God into captivity. Like I said, these are true believers of these the people groups. And what's the biggest insult that someone like the Assyrians could do to you? Well, it's probably, your God is weak. We got your God. We got your God. We captured your God. This is devastating to your whole people when your God is captured.
Yeah, the only time that this was attempted in Israel, we covered that back in Samuel, early chapters of Samuel, is when the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
Yeah. That didn't turn out very well for the Philistines, if you remember, or their gods. In fact, it didn't take very long before they're like, hey, you can have the ark back. In fact, we're going to send some sacrifices to atone for our wrongdoing, along with returning your ark to you. So, yeah, messing with Israel's God was never going to end up being a positive move for you.
Yeah, and actually, so, in some of the historical writings too, when some of the people groups that decide to combine forces and end up like kind of having rebellions and stuff, a big impetus for this is somebody will go to somebody else and they'll say, "Hey, did they take your God?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, they have our God. They melted our God down." This would be a way for them to join forces. And, you know, so if you go to someone and be like, "Why do you hate them?" They're like, "Well, they took my God and they threw it in the ocean." Fair enough. I guess that'd make you hate somebody.
That would do it. It would do it. And it's a good reminder, too. I mean, we tend to think in little cubicles today. You know, we have our politics over here. We have religion over here. We have whatever over here. All of those little cubicles would laughably non-existent in the ancient world. Your politics and your theology were not distinct categories. I mean, politics were theological and your theology was political. It was all woven together because every aspect of your life was understood to be religious.
Yeah, you didn't go to war and not talk to your God about it.
Oh yeah, but unthinkable. Yeah, unthinkable.
You gotta go find a seer, have them like, you know, examine some liver and be like, like, you know, that'd be something, right? Gotta throw some bones on the ground. I don't know. You gotta do something to figure out if this is what you're supposed to do or not.
Yeah, I don't simply take a vote.
No.
And then decide what you're gonna do. I mean, so all the beliefs about God or gods or a god or whatever is part of a culture, those are woven into every aspect of that society from top down. So God says, "Hey, I planned this a long time ago. You don't know what you're talking about." And then he goes on, verse 27 and 28, which would be the last two verses of the section from Isaiah. "I know you're sitting down." you gotta kind of feel how this leads to the end. So I know you're sitting down, and you're going out, and you're coming in. And that might sound like good so far. Like, oh, I know. It's kind of Psalm 139, right? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I go to Sheol, you are there. You know, you know my sitting down, my rising, you know all this. But no, listen to the way the verse ends. I know you're sitting down. I know you're going out and you're coming in and you're raging against me. So none of this escapes God's notice. I know every single action you perform every day. If you're sitting on the throne, or if you're sitting on the toilet, if you're going out of your house, if you're coming back home. I know all that, and I know especially the way that you rage against me. And because you have raged against me, and your complacency has come into my ears, I think that's an allusion back to Hezekiah's prayer, right? I've heard about this. Hezekiah's told me about it. That's that your complacency has come into my ears. So because of all that, here's what I'm going to do to you. You got to love this image too. I'm going to put my hook in your nose. I'm going to put my bit in your mouth, and I will turn you back on the way by which you came. It's a mic drop moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so basically he begins by talking about how the Assyrian king thinks he's just, you know, he's this godlike human. He's done all these fantastic things. You know, he's the big guy. He's the king of kings. Well, you get to the end and God says, "Oh yeah, I'm going to treat you like just a regular beast of burden." Just like you'd put a bit into a horse's mouth to make him go where you want him to go, or you put a hook into the nose of some animal and drag it the way you want it to go, that's what I'm going to do to you. So he takes this guy who's elevated himself to the level of a god and says, "No, I'm going to treat you like a beast to remind you," it's kind of a Nebuchadnezzar kind of thing, "to remind you of really who God is and then who you are."
Yeah, that imagery is pretty good. You get this idea of this guy that thinks he is not just a king, but a god, having a hook in his nose, and God's got his finger in it, and he's just pulling him along.
Yeah, it's a slap in the face, big time, when you get to the end. You got to love the prophetic preaching. Talk about spines of steel. These guys spoke the truth pretty forcefully. Okay, so that's the end of the poetry. Now we have more that's going to be said. It's verse 29. "And this shall be the sign for you." Now the "you" here is shifted. So he's been talking through Isaiah about the Assyrian king, and now he's going to switch and he's going to talk about King Hezekiah as well as the Israelites. So this can be a sign for all you folks. Here's the way this is going to happen. This year, eat what grows of itself, and in the second year, what springs of the same. And then in the third year, sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat of their fruit. And the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord will do this. This language about this year eating basically just what grows naturally, and then the next year eating what grows naturally, you know, without any sowing and reaping and all that kind of stuff. And then in the third year, you're gonna sow and reap and plant vineyards, has led some people to suggest that actually all this is happening during a Jubilee season. So remember that during the Jubilee season, you had a couple of years where the land was allowed to lie fallow. You didn't go out there and work it like regular farmers would. Instead, you just ate what grew of itself. So every 50th year. So a lot of people suggest that, or some people suggest that that might be what is kind of being alluded to here, because this is the exact language of the Jubilee, where you have a couple of years where the land lies fallow, you just eat what grows naturally. So whether that's the case, or whether it's, you know, the land has been devastated by all these Assyrians coming in, but the land is still going to be fruitful, that might be another meaning here. But either way, this is what God is telling them, that the crops are going to grow naturally for 2 years in a row, and then third year, you can go out and you can sow and reap and plant vineyards.
Yeah, one of my favorite lines in the Old Testament, whenever I see it, is that the zeal of the Lord will do this. It's always, this is a good closing sort of statement. It wraps up whatever that thought was. So here's all this stuff that's going to happen, and the reason it's going to happen is not because anything that you got going on, anything that you did, it's not because of your faithfulness, or it's not because I'm not partnering up with you to do this. This is going to be done out of my own zeal. That is out of my own passion, right? The passion of the Lord is why this will come to pass.
Yeah, you have that accented several times, I think in crucial parts of scripture too, because you can get the impression that, you know, we talk about how Hezekiah was just, you know, nobody was, he was the best, you know, he was just a great king. And so you can get the impression that because of that, God is going to look with favor upon Israel. So for the sake of Hezekiah, he's going to do all this. But no, that's not the case at all. He's wanting to make sure that, yeah, it's great that you have a righteous king and he's doing some good things, but it's not because of him that all this is going to happen. No, it's going to be me. Yeah. My zeal, my passion, like you said, my holy jealousy on behalf of my people. That's why all of this is going to happen. That's why you're going to have crops. That's why you're going to take root downward and bear fruit upward, which is another kind of gripping image that you have here of the fruitfulness of his people. Because there's going to be a remnant that's going to go out of Jerusalem. That she'arit in Hebrew, that word for remnant is pretty significant throughout the rest of the prophets, because many of them will talk about a remnant being saved. And it's the idea of the seed and the stump, or various other metaphors that are used for God always preserving this core of his people. He's not going, in other words, going to decimate everybody. There's always going to be a remnant. And this remnant, of course, will continue all the way until the coming of Christ. And this is the remnant that God will use to keep his promises alive, to keep his word alive throughout these intervening centuries.
Yeah, I mean, if you're sort of wondering, what's the difference between God doing something because God's sovereign and God doing something with zeal? And I think the answer is, well, there's things that God does or God is over. But whenever you read sort of this, the zeal of the Lord will do this, this is the difference between me doing something and me being all in on something. Like I'm fully committed to this thing. And what is that thing? Well, in this case, it's talking about preserving a remnant, right? And God said, and it's basically God saying, I'm passionate about this. This is not just like, yes, I'm sovereign, but this isn't just like another thing that I'm doing. I'm all in on this remnant thing.
Yeah, and the verb itself, I mean, the word itself about like the zeal or the passion. I mean, that's also sometimes translated as jealousy. So it's and jealousy is it, we tend to think of that as a negative emotion or negative inclination. That's not the way it's presented with regard to God. I mean, he's jealous in the sense of he wants his people to be all his because he is all theirs. So it's just another way of expressing his intense, ferocious love toward them. So that's why he's doing it. You know, it's not just kind of a bland sovereign power that motivates him to do these things. He does this because he's a God of passion and love for his bride Israel. And so that's why he does all of these things on her behalf.
Yeah. It seems that in scripture, if the zeal of the Lord is invoked, look out.
Yeah. Yeah. That means things are going to go great for his people and not for whoever stands against his people. And then he's not done. So verse 32 says more about what's going to happen to the king of Syria. So therefore, thus says the Lord concerning this king of Syria, he shall not come into this city or shoot an arrow here or come before it with a shield or cast a siege mount against it. So he ain't going to do none of that. None of this stuff. None of his warfare things. He's not going to show up. He's not even going to draw his bow back and shoot a single arrow here or stand before it and, you know, shake his shield. He's certainly not going to cast up some siege mound in a long, prolonged siege. Nope. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it. You could just take those words alone, and it's kind of a great summary of this. When God says, I'm going to defend this city to save it, well, then end of story. You know you're good. And why is he going to do it? This is kind of building on what we've already been talking about. I will defend it. I will save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. Now, for my own sake is obvious. He's not doing it, you know, because the people have been so great or something like that. Now, when you hear for the sake of my servant David, hear that in connection with all the stuff that we've talked about in connection with David in the past. He's talking about the promise he made to David to establish a dynasty of his sons, to eventually raise up one of those sons, the Messiah, to sit on the throne over an everlasting kingdom. So don't hear for the sake of my servant. For the sake of my pious, holy, good, wonderful, faithful David, I'm doing all this. No, this is talking about his promise that he's made to David. So basically, for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David, is God's way of saying, I'm going to defend the city, I'm going to save it, because I have promised to do so. And I'm a God who keeps his promises.
Yeah, it's awesome that he says that I'm going to do this for my namesake and for the sake of my servant David. When David has one of the best namesake things ever and probably the most famous psalm of all time, you know, Psalm 23, David says, he, the Lord, leads me in paths of righteousness for his namesake.
Yeah.
God here says, right, I'm going to save my people for my namesake and for the sake of my servant David, who also knows that I do these things because I'm a promise-keeping God. This is actually the best. This is the best when this happens. Like, what you want God to intervene in your life for his namesake more than for anything else. Because if it's dependent on you, like, I don't know, you probably don't deserve it. It's way better if he does it because of him. You know, and whenever you hear this, it's like, what is this? Does it just mean like I'm going to do it for my own glory? Well, certainly you have passages like that. But mostly what he's doing here is he's saying, I made a promise to David that I intend on keeping. It's the same stuff that we went over when Moses gets into arguments with God about why he can't destroy his own people and stuff. Why can't you do it? Because the nations will call you a liar.
Mm-hmm.
And God's like, well, I'm not a liar. And so this is why. So why is God going to do this? He's going to do it because he's like, I'm not going to be, I am, it's not going to be said that I'm a liar. And it's almost like the one thing, people can say all kinds of things about God, and I don't know if God's too concerned about it. It doesn't seem like he's concerned if they think he's mean or whatever, but it does seem that God is very concerned with not being called a liar.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. And you say that over and over, in sometimes in explicit sorts of ways, sometimes it's kind of woven into the story, where if God has if God has, as it were, written out what he's going to do and signed his name to it, then whatever he said he's going to do and signed his name to, then you can bet the farm on the fact that that is what's going to happen. He's never going to lie. He's never going to, you know, add footnotes at the bottom in the fine print, give him a way out of it. He's always going to stick by what he says, what he promises. And so for him to act for his own sake, for his own name's sake, is basically to say that he is a God who, when he makes a promise, when he says, I'm the Lord your God, then he will be the Lord your God. When he says, I love you, then he will love you. When he says, I'm going to do this for David, then he will do that for David. Now, that might not happen when we want it to happen. Mm-hmm. It might not even happen the way that we want it to happen, but it will happen because there is no other option for God. He will always tell the truth, and he will always stand by the truth for the sake of his name. And it's not just a matter of honor. It's a matter of him being true to his own nature as a God who cannot lie and the God who is love. So because of that, he's going to always do what he's promised.
Well, it's a very good thing because of this. You might be tempted to believe that, oh, so God just keeps his promises because he doesn't like being called a liar. No, he keeps his promises because he doesn't want to be a liar, because he wants you to be able to believe him.
Yeah, right. That way that we know our faith is certain.
Yeah.
It's not a maybe sort of faith. Well, maybe, yeah. I hope, possibly, God might do this. If God has said that he will, then he will. Now, to wrap up this chapter, we just have three or four verses left. So, and as a great segue to explaining exactly how God keeps his promises, well, that's basically the way the chapter ends. He says, he writes that night, the messenger of the Lord, usually translated the angel of the Lord. This is the Malach Yahweh. So we've talked about the messenger of the Lord over and over and over and over. So this is the second person of the Trinity. This is the Lord's messenger. What does he do out? What does he do? He went out and he struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And everybody got up in the morning. Behold, great use of behold here. Behold, look, these were all dead bodies. Then Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went home and lived at Nineveh. And now this is presented as if it happens like right when he got home. We know this was many years later, but when he was home, as he was worshiping, quite appropriately, I think, in the house of his god, Nisroch, then two of his sons, Adrammelech and Sharezer, struck him down with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place.
It didn't have to take very. It didn't have to wait very long for God to keep that promise, did you?
No, this was not one of those down the road, like as in centuries. No, this is very quickly.
Yeah, you gotta like it because it's in that night. This is a pretty quick, and it's great because God makes all these promises. He invokes David. He says, "I'm going to do this for my own namesake." What does he do that night? He sends Jesus. It's pretty great.
Not the usual image we have of Jesus wielding a sword, killing all these Assyrians, but it's a revelation kind of image for sure. And I mean, the whole purpose, of course, was to save his people, to keep the promise that he made. And then also at the same time, you see what's happening to the Assyrian king, kind of a fitting judgment in the sense that he who had defied the true and living God, where is he killed? Where is he assassinated? And by whom? By his own family, by two of his own sons. And while he's in the very temple of his God. So a fitting judgment for the one who spoke these arrogant words against the true Lord. So that is a huge, hugely important episode in the life of Hezekiah. Now, next episode, chapter 20, we're going to hear about something else that happened to Hezekiah, which is more kind of personal in nature, where when he becomes sick and has another little discussion with Isaiah. So we'll get to that in the next episode.
All right. Sounds good, man. Well, we will be back next week to talk more about Hezekiah. We still got a good king making a run here. So we get another episode of a good king. So that's been a nice change. So
nice change for sure. Yeah.
So we'll be back with more from Hezekiah next week. I'll see you then, Chad.
All right, see you then.